Good morning, everybody. My name is Tony Goodens, the director of the LSE. It's my great pleasure to welcome you all here this morning, and my great privilege to welcome the Prime Minister, Tony Blair. I think most people recognise this is an important moment for New Labour in this country and for the European centre-left more generally. Only about 3 or 4 years ago, 11 out of 15 EU countries had governments which were either headed by centre-left parties or by centre-left coalitions. More recently, that number has experienced a sharp downturn with the triumph of the right in a range of elections across the EU, such as in Italy, Denmark, Austria, and other countries. And in the two big countries of the EU, France and Germany, the up-and-coming elections are really too close to call at the moment. In this country, New Labour is back in power after a second landslide victory. I think a remarkable achievement by any standards, low turnout notwithstanding. But any party to be successful needs a marching tune. It needs something with which the electorate can resonate. It needs something not just of intellectual power, but which has emotional appeal to the citizens. And it needs a thread, a line of development to the future. These are the themes, I believe, in which the Prime Minister is going to speak this morning. So please give another warm welcome to the Prime Minister, Tony Blair.
Thank you very much, Tony, and thank you, everyone, for coming to this lecture this morning. And thank you for the LSE's kind offices and allowing us to come here and make this lecture. And can I pay tribute, too, to all the work that Tony Giddens does? I mean, very often I bump into prime ministers, presidents around the world who tell me that they really no need to see me because they've already seen Mr. Tony Giddens, and that's quite sufficient for them. But he has done a tremendous amount to stimulate debate about progressive politics right around the world, and we're very grateful to him. Just under a decade ago, a gathering like this would have been awake, raking over the ashes of Labour's fourth election defeat, with everyone asking, can we ever win? Is the left in Britain doomed? Is this the end of progressive politics? I think we all remember those conversations. Today, the contrast is almost taken for granted. Labour has won an historic second term, as if we had been in power for decades. The right is seen as divided and incapable. We are emerging from a long period in which Tory values held sway. Elitism, selfish individualism, the belief that there is no such thing as society, and its international equivalent, insularity and isolationism, which led Britain to turn its back on Europe and the world. I passionately and profoundly reject these values. I reject elitism because I believe that our country will only ever fulfil its true potential when all of our people are allowed to fulfil theirs. I believe there is such a thing as society. As communities and as an international community, I believe we do best when we work in cooperation with others. These values, our belief in equality, in progress, our belief in the power of community to be a force for good at home and abroad, these are the values that hold sway now. But as Mario Cuomo once said, you campaign in poetry, you govern in prose. And there is a danger in the day-to-day business of government, keeping the economy on track, getting the details of health and education improvements sorted, dealing with the innumerable practical obstacles, large and small, strewn across the path of progress, that we lose sight somehow of the destination. The destination, to me, is clear. To build a Britain that is modern, tolerant, outward-looking, where power, wealth, and opportunity are in the hands of the many, not the few. Our basic analysis is that people are held back from fulfilling their true potential by economic failure, poor education, by poverty, prejudice, discrimination, class, inadequate access to quality public services. Our job, therefore, is to liberate that potential, to remove those barriers, to make aspiration and achievement not the ambition of a privileged few, but of all, where the limit to your achievement is merit, not birth or class or race or gender. Britain under the Conservatives was a long way from that lofty ideal. And because we had failed to modernise ourselves, for a long time, Labour lacked the credibility to be able to win power, or even, perhaps if we had won power, to be able to deliver on that ideal. But now, two election victories later, people are asking, can we carry it through? Is there a core of beliefs, as well as policies, that will sustain us? Will we be submerged by the slings and arrows of an outrageous opposition, furious that we're in power at all, never mind in power for a full second term for the first time in our history? And I think the answer to that basic question posed to us at this moment in time, is to take stock, to lift our eyes from the immediate, to hold high again the ideals we're striving for, and then to return to work with renewed energy and determination. And, of course, patience, because these fundamental changes take time. Yet consider, an economy that is stable has weathered the downturn better than many, with the best economic record in Europe, the lowest unemployment in the Western world, the first clear signs of public service improvements, certainly in education, increasingly in health, the first concerted attack on social exclusion any government has undertaken, with increased participation rates at work, 1 million children out of poverty, Sure Start and other programs, giving some of our most deprived children at least the chance, a fighting chance, of a decent start in life. Overall crime down, police numbers the highest ever, and Britain's position and influence in the world, I would suggest, incomparably higher than it was 5 years ago. In all sorts of small ways, from banning handguns to the equal age of consent, to the trebling of women MPs, the first black ministers, the first Muslim MPs, the country has a different feel to it from the harshness of the Thatcher years. Yes, naturally, of course, a huge amount still remains to be done. Too many people still wait an unacceptably long time for National Health Service treatment. The transport system is nowhere near what the world's fourth largest economy demands. Street crime, social disintegration in parts of the inner city are a menace that we have to tackle quickly. There are still many people who could work but don't. Still too much ignorance, too much wasted potential, too much inequality. We accept these challenges remain. And the forward programme of the government is designed to meet them, still driven by that same ideal of a modern, fairer Britain where opportunity is open to all. My submission to you is that what we have to do is to explain that journey by reference to the ideals as well as the programme, to blow away the fog that is designed to cloud the sight of it and work even harder to translate it into reality. So today I call on those who share those beliefs, those values, to join us in the battles that now lie ahead. Join us in the battle to extend prosperity and full employment to all parts of the country, based on that platform of economic stability. Join us in the battle for the investment and reform necessary to build strong public services, because they encourage greater opportunity and equality. Join us in the battle to tackle crime, antisocial behaviour, and poverty and the causes of crime, to build a society genuinely based on rights and responsibilities. Join us in the battle against the sceptics and the phobes to get Britain back once again at the top table of Europe. That is the progressive project for a second term. The next steps for the new Labour project, an ambitious programme for the Labour Party as it enters its second century. But to chart those next steps, I think we have to understand our first steps a little better. The collapse of the Labour Party and its electoral base, most painfully dramatised by the defeat in 1992, was only the most obvious sign of a broader shift in politics and society.
Labour stuttered when confronted by the new world that emerged in the 70s and 80s. A more diverse, fractured society, new industries, new attitudes to work and consumption, and an international order that was both more integrated and yet also more unpredictable. In fact, back in 1956, Tony Crossland had set out a new path in his book, The Future of Socialism. He urged socialists to acknowledge the successes of post-war capitalism, to understand the consumer society, and why it was advancing so fast in the traditional heartlands of labour. Unfortunately, in the 70s, we seem to forget that revisionist message. A new labour was in part a response to what had gone wrong. We strove, therefore, to modernise social democracy, to become a party that could bring together wealth creation as well as wealth distribution, enterprise as well as fairness. So New Labour put levelling up the aspirations of the majority at the centre of its appeal, a huge change. And we changed our constitution to bring it up to date with the modern world. So that first phase of New Labour was becoming a modern social democratic party fit for government. The second phase was to use our 1997 victory to put in place the foundations that would allow us to change the country in a way that lasts. And this is a point I want to emphasise. In the past, Labour governments have tried to make progress without firm foundations, firm economic foundations in particular. Getting those foundations right is not time wasted. It's not the boring housework of government. It's actually the structure within which we live. That is why we transformed the framework for economic management. We did it for that reason. It matters whether prices in the supermarket are the same from one week to the next. It matters that today inflation is at its lowest level for 30 years. It matters whether interest rates let you pay the mortgage or threaten you with the loss of your home. Today it matters that the average family is paying somewhere in the region of £1,800 a year less on their mortgage compared to the early 90s. On welfare reform, getting the first-term foundations meant tackling unemployment. The New Deal has helped halve unemployment, now at its lowest level for 40 years. We then introduced the Working Families Tax Credit, the minimum wage, to try and make sure that work paid. On public services, whatever the scale of the challenge that we face now, it's just important to reconsider for a moment the scale of the challenge we inherited in 1997. Crime had doubled. Waiting lists under Conservatives had risen by 400,000. Hospital beds had been cut by 60,000. Training places virtually across the public services had been cut. Nearly half of all 11-year-olds were failing to reach the basic standards. Infant class sizes were too high. Child poverty had tripled. Investment in rail and the tube had stalled. The railways had been subject to a botched privatisation which had fragmented them completely. In every single area, therefore, there was a huge amount to be done. And in each area in the first term, we did indeed lay the foundations for investment and reform. A strategy for improving numeracy and literacy in primary schools, with record primary school test results to show for it. A 10-year plan for the National Health Service, published in 2000, including the first ever independent inspection, league tables, the creation of primary care trusts, now coming to fruition to transform local services. More doctors, 31,000 more nurses since 1997. In crime, crime and disorder partnerships in every community, police numbers rising. Our youth justice system overhauled. Burglary fell by 34%, car crime by 24%. The old report on the criminal justice system was commissioned. There was published, too, a 10-year transport plan, which will over time treble public sector investment in rail and tube. There was devolution, House of Lords reform, first stage, a peace process begun in Northern Ireland. We set the foundations of a new foreign policy. Before the Amsterdam summit in 1997, the first summit I attended as Prime Minister, I remember going to that summit, and Britain was totally isolated, treated with something between exasperation and contempt. Today, as we approach the next summit in a few days' time at Barcelona, We approach it as one of the leaders of Europe in a highly influential position. We have a strong constructive relationship with our European partners, and we've helped lead the way in the world over issues like Kosovo, more recently Afghanistan, and perhaps as important as anything else, on issues like debt and development and aid. So, in each of these areas, in that first term, foundations were laid. Real change was procured. But now is the third phase of New Labour. This phase is about, on those foundations, driving forward reforms, building that lasting change and a better society on the basis of those foundations so carefully laid. So, for example, on the basis of economic stability, the new task now is a sustained improvement in productivity, in enterprise, measures that will form a key part of next month's budget. The criminal justice system is going to be overhauled to support victims and witnesses, bring the most persistent offenders to justice. And those reforms, the bills containing those reforms, will effectively dominate the legislative session, this Parliament. A thorough programme of police reform and a reform of the asylum system. There will be welfare reform that cuts even further the numbers of working age on benefit, plus integrating the children's credit, the new pensions credit. And there is a huge cultural change going on in Britain's welfare system. Not given much publicity, but the merger of the employment and benefit services is literally changing the fundamental basis upon which Britain's welfare system has performed since 1945. We must complete House of Lords reform, we must bed down devolution, and we must make the peace process in Northern Ireland durable for the long term. Britain has to take its rightful and leading place at the centre of Europe. We must implement the Plan for Africa, continue to lead on aid and development, and implement the Kyoto Protocol on climate change as the basis for sustainable development in the world. All this together with the war against international terrorism. It's a huge agenda. And alongside it all, the core mission for this third phase is to improve our public services. Again, in each service, there is a comprehensive, detailed plan for change and reform, broadly supported within the public services themselves. Underlying the plans within each service area are the four principles of reform that we set out just last week. National standards, devolution to the front line within those standards, more flexible terms and conditions of employment for staff, more choice. All aimed at redesigning high-quality public services around the consumer. That reform programme will go through. But I think we know that without investment, reform will get you very little further, as the Tories found in the 1980s. There is no point designing new structures for the health service if we don't tackle the fundamental problem of inadequate capacity and fashion the reforms around the significant increase in capacity essential to build a modern consumer-focused service. And it's the same with schools, transport, and across our public services. Under this government, there will be no blank checks, but nor will we expect the public services to run on empty. So in next month's budget, and then the spending review in the summer, the country is faced with a fundamental choice. Either we continue investing, or we cut back. And we, this new Labour government, aims to continue investing. There is no question of putting money into some bottomless pit. Each pound spent will be accounted for. But when people say that the money that's already gone in has been wasted, I say we can see already where the existing extra investment has gone. The extra money on infant class sizes reduced those class sizes. The money spent on literacy and numeracy, together with the dedication of teachers, delivered the results. The schools with new buildings, go to those schools and tell them the money's been wasted. The new surgical centres, the extra cancer and heart operations, the extra critical care beds, the extra nurses in wards. Tell the patients using these facilities that the money's all wasted. So we know and acknowledge that money alone is not enough. But money that is investment that can lever in change That is what will work in the long term for our public services. So, these are, broadly, the second term ambitions of the government. And again, broadly, I believe that they're supported by the country. The things that we're focusing on are the things the country wants us to focus on. But it's not enough. There is a clear roadmap to our destination. But I think the danger is that sometimes it can be seen as some technocratic exercise, managed well or less well, but with no overriding moral purpose or values behind it. What I believe is vital now is to explain the why of the programme, to describe it not simply point by point, but also principle by principle. The reason for the changes we are making is not for their own sake, but because they are the means to the fairer society where aspirations and opportunities are available to all, which we believe in. The programme that I'm setting out, whether on the economy, public services, crime, or abroad, is not driven by administration. It's driven by values. It means quality public services. Why? Because quality public services are social justice made real. It means an economy with a new job if your old job goes. It means stable mortgage rates. It means giving the children of someone who didn't go to university the hope that they can go. And let us have enough of this nonsense. The more than half the population don't have the brains to get there. When I was a student, 7% of school leavers went to university. Today it's 33% and rising. Yet we heard the same arguments back then. Are we really saying those extra 26% were undeserving? Opportunity means a young woman with a nursing diploma who is able to work her way up to become a consultant nurse or a director of nursing or a hospital chief executive. It means a first-rate vocational system in our education so that people can get new and better skills. It means children in deprived areas getting first-class schools, their parents help, their environment improved. It means your healthcare shouldn't depend on the size of your wallet. It means your security shouldn't depend on the neighbourhood you can afford to live in. That's what opportunity and values mean. And it means that decent, hard-working people who play by the rules don't see others who refuse to play by the rules gain by it. And that's the other part of what we believe in. We believe in responsibility going with the opportunity. That's the reason for the measures to curb antisocial behaviour, to ensure that if people have the ability to work and are offered a job, they don't remain dependent on benefit, that employers treat their employees fairly, that we act against poverty pay, that increasingly the polluter should pay for polluting the environment. That's why we're making a priority now of discipline in the classroom. Because without learning discipline and respect, children will not only fail to learn at school, but leave school unfit to be decent citizens. So it's about those two things, those two beliefs coming together, opportunity and responsibility. And then it's about using our collective power in our local communities, in society, through government, to enable people to help themselves. And at the root of it all is a simple belief in fairness. That's essentially why people like myself joined the Labour Party. It's not desperately complicated. It usually didn't come through a textbook. It came because of that simple belief in fairness. It isn't fair that people are held back or live in poverty or can't fulfil their potential. And we want to change it. And amidst all the day-to-day pressures, that is our ideal. That's what we hold aloft. And of course, sometimes it's hard to see it. But in the end, it is the values and the ideals that will see us through any difficult times. My final point is this. I think it's important to understand why people can sometimes find the ideals obscured. And it's not just that governments get embroiled in events and controversies, though they do. And whilst they dominate the news, the people think, well, what on earth are they concentrating on that for? When, of course, it's the very opposite of what we're trying to do. But I think there's another reason for it, and it's this. that for some, even in our own ranks, the idea of New Labour remains controversial or unclear. Even now, a large part of the political discourse in Britain assumes that, in inverted commas, the true Labour Party is the one that puts trade unions before business, is indifferent to financial discipline, addicted to tax and spend, weak on issues of crime, irresponsible over state benefits for the unemployed or socially excluded, backs the producer interest in public services, and give or take the odd exception, is weak in defence and foreign policy. Now, since the government is plainly none of those things, ergo we're not real Labour and are unprincipled. And, of course, you'll be familiar with this, it suits immensely the right wing in politics. They absolutely love the true Labour Party. Our positions made it unelectable, but it also suits some on the left, who see the Labour Party as a pressure group. We campaign against those with power, we fight for the positions we have, we rejoice in our principles, are given the odd crumb from the governing table, and avoid the harsh realities of taking any hard decisions. Now, after 18 years of Conservative government, it's true, we changed all that. And I'm not so naive to deny that some change simply to win. Banging your head on a brick wall hurts. At some point, if you want to stop hurting, you devise the brilliant solution of ceasing to bang your head on the wall. But actually, changing these positions to win was never the right reason for changing them. Nor can it sustain us over the long term. The right reason for the change in the Labour Party was a principled one, because the positions hallowed by the party over many years were a tangled and mistaken view of the party's true raison d'etre and values. Positions that were often the product of the circumstances of our birth, of 20th century politics and ideology, and of the post-war settlement. The real values of the Labour Party are the values of progressive politics throughout the ages. The same values as those of the great liberal reformers of the 19th century and early 20th century, as well as those of the Labour heroes in 1945. And those beliefs in social justice, opportunity for all, liberty, the belief that the individual does best in a strong community and society of others, those are basically the beliefs of progressive politics that predate the Labour Party and will continue through time immemorial. And the essence of New Labour, the whole purpose of it, was to strip away all the outdated dogma and doctrine, the hallowed positions, and return to those first principles and to those values. And then we ask, if these are our values, what is their proper translation into practice for today's world? And I would say to you, that is the question each generation of Labour members should ask, and answer it in a different way. Now, in 1997, we answered it in this way. And this is what is important in understanding the journey that we've undertaken and the phases of Labour that we've made. We answered it by saying that if we want strong economic growth to increase the prosperity of ordinary citizens, we need low inflation, low interest rates, and that meant financial discipline, a principled reason for it. If we want enterprise to flourish in the post-industrial economy, to give our people jobs, we need to support and work with business. And levels of tax shouldn't discourage the entrepreneur, because we need more of them. If we want to protect the poor and vulnerable against attack and crime, we had to make sure that the criminal is brought to justice. If we want to stop the working age poor being poor, we need to help them to work, not give them more benefit, which frankly, not on any basis, would ever provide them with a decent income. If we want to rebuild our public services, they have then to work for the consumers of those services, because they're the very people most dependent on them for opportunity and help. And if we want to shape the world around us outside Britain, we must build the alliances necessary and, where necessary, the armed forces to allow us to do so. So, those changes were made from principle, for reasons of principle. And yes, we are financially disciplined, but one of the ways we got there was through the New Deal, cutting massively the bills of unemployment. Yes, we work with business, but we also introduce the minimum wage. Yes, we're reforming our public services, but we're also the only major country today, anywhere in the Western world, increasing public spending on health and education as a proportion of our national income. Yes, we're tough on crime, but we've also lifted 1 million children out of poverty, cut pensioner poverty, have huge inner-city regeneration programs underway, I had a discussion this morning with our education ministers about how we make sure that kids that are excluded from class get proper teaching, as opposed to a couple of hours a week and then they're simply floated off into the local community where they cause trouble on the streets. You know, we're doing a massive amount to tackle the social causes of crime at the same time. And yes, we are prepared to take military action where necessary, but are also leading the way on debt relief and international development, especially in Africa. Now, when you put all these positions together, hence the confusion I talked of earlier, we don't fit the mold, and that's good because we never intended to. Why don't we just conform? Because we shouldn't. The modern Labour Party is here to stay because it is based on values and principle and is the right way forward for us and for the country. So my point to you is that we should have confidence. We should hold firm to our course and, above all, hold true to the basis of New Labour. We are changing the basis of British politics. Progressive values are actually in the ascendant here in this country today because, in the end, they are, in fact, also the values of the great majority of British people, and they only required to be applied in a modern way for those values to be popular. Look how our opponents are coming onto our agenda. What a reversal in these last 10 years to see the Conservatives now falling over themselves to agree with our economic policy, hoping some of our economic competence rubs off on them, travelling round Europe to look at public services, though dodging the test of whether they support the extra investment. As someone once said, success in politics is not changing your own party, it's changing the opposition. The Lib Dems, they don't know whether to oppose us on reform for opportunism's sake, because they know change can be unpopular, or scuttle to our right as a pay limitation of the Tories calling for tax cuts. The truth is, for all the difficulties, the centre of gravity of British politics is moving in a progressive direction. A new post-Thatcherite progressive consensus is being born, is taking shape, and it's one that we should be proud of. A consensus that a dynamic economy and a fairer society, where we realise the potential of all, in fact go together and are not opposites. A consensus that our public services have been underinvested in for two decades and now need sustained investment coupled with reform. And we, as a political movement and party, should understand this consensus, not be frightened by it, because, in fact, it is a vital part of our ability to change Britain. So what I say to you is, help us get there. Because we also need the energy, the vitality, the ideas, the commitment of people outside government. We can't do it alone. No sustained political movement that produces change over a long period of time produces change just by the activities of politicians. It requires a connection out in civic society with people who understand the values and direction of the government, get behind it, support it where necessary, criticise it where necessary, and enter into a dialogue for change. That dialogue and partnership that we offer is actually an indispensable part of the government being successful. So remember 10 years ago, we were on our knees, out of office and out of hope. But now look forward 10 years and imagine what could be possible. A society that is fairer, more tolerant of people's differences, with prosperity shared, quality public services, more social mobility and less poverty. And imagine too what we could achieve pulling together if we show our determination, stick to the values we believe are right, stick to those plans I've outlined and see them through. We are in this third phase of New Labour's development. The first was reconstructing the party. The second was laying the foundations. The third is now driving through change and reform. The point that I've been making today is that none of it works unless it's connected and drawn together by values and beliefs. And what we have to do now is explain to people not merely why we're trying to make the changes in our country in technical terms, but why we're trying to do them in terms of belief, in terms of basic opportunities for people, in terms of helping hard-working people to make sense of their lives, to get on and do well and fulfil their potential. And it's a fantastic opportunity for us. You only have to see the confusion of our political opponents to realise the huge opportunity we've got. But we can't be complacent about it. It depends on us to deliver it. That progressive consensus is there. Yes, it's true, in other parts of Europe, centre-left governments have gone out of power. But last year, our government got re-elected. And what's more, we got re-elected against a political party playing all the cards that traditionally you would have said got you elected. Playing their cards on asylum and race, playing their cards on tax cuts before investment in public services, playing their cards on a sort of phony nationalism that had Britain withdrawing to the margins of Europe, and they lost. And they lost because in the end, the British people understand that the values that we hold dear are in fact the true values for this country. But they need to know that we've got the commitment to the modernisation and change necessary to deliver those values in the world in which they live. And it's that combination of programme and values that will see us through to a Britain that is modern, fair and strong. Thank you.